who is at the CFA, a colleague of mine, except he's a graduate student in the astronomy department, and we're very happy to be inculcating him in the fascinating EHT. So Andrew, after 15 minutes, I'll give you a 5-minute talk warning, and then a 1-minute warning, and then you have 5 for questions. Okay, thanks.
Great. Okay, can you hear me? Good. No? Hello?
Yeah,
okay.
I think that's good.
Yeah. Okay. So, my name's Andrew. Thanks for being here. I'm a grad student, just started working with the EHT this last summer, and I'm going to talk about some stuff that we've been doing at CFA, and also some stuff people have been doing at Haystack about time variability. So I think a big theme over the last week has been, on the one hand, that the EHT is not just an instrument that takes an image, it's something that's going to have enormous time sensitivity, especially thanks to all this technical work that we saw yesterday that is increasing the bandwidth. And so we're going to really be able to both spatially and temporally resolve things happening on event horizon scales with the EHT. On the other hand, I think we saw in the first few days was that time variability is very complicated and there's really no agreement as to what the EHT might exactly see and how to extract physics out of what the EHT observes. So my goal with this talk is not really to answer that question, and I think it still requires a lot more work, but to review, I think, a little bit what's been done, and to maybe point some directions forward in using various quantities, closure phases and amplitudes, polarization, to constrain physics at event horizon scales. So just a brief review, the time scales that we see with the EHT range from minutes to potentially years. At Sagittarius Star, we have turbulence from the MRI, potentially, in minutes. We see flares in minutes to hours. Michael, this afternoon, or right after break, we'll talk about refractive scattering effects, which could be on day time scales. And then potentially, within Sagittarius Star and other objects observed by the EHT, we might be able to track dynamics over months to years, things like precession and quasar jets and things. But I'm going to be focusing on those effects which are less than observation time, so less than one full Earth rotation, mostly in the minutes to hour range. So we know that the gravitational time scale of Sagittarius Star is very short, 21 seconds, and the ISCO period, if it's maximally spinning, is only a few minutes. So really we expect to see very fast variability. And indeed, in total intensity and in polarization, people have been looking at flares for a long time. These flares occur in near-infrared X-ray and submillimeter, and they look like this. So often, they seem to be highly correlated between all three wavelengths, so that's still, I guess, up for debate. Between X-ray and infrared, it's expected that there's a synchrotron process generating the X-ray flare from the infrared photons, the submillimeter, it's less clear what's going on there. But that's only on the level of total flux. And so what the EHT really allows us to do is to measure variability not only just from the total emission, but also to spatially resolve it. And in fact, this has already been done in 2011. From 2009 data, a 2011 paper by Vincent shows the change in visibility amplitude over 2 consecutive days. So you see the total flux rose by 17% between these 2 days, but also the visibility amplitudes both on the SMA Karma baseline and on the 2 baselines to Hawaii rose as well. And if you fit a Gaussian to that, the total size of this Gaussian doesn't change between these days. So there's potentially some indication of physics going on here, and it's the first detection that we've already made of time variability that's also spatially resolved. So I'm going to be focusing on 2 problems, which are essentially, how do we image this quiescent structure when we have all, we expect to have all of this turbulence on top of it? And how do we potentially begin to think about extracting physics of variability from what we have as VLBI observables? So we've all seen simulations like this. The last few days, this is from Hotaka Shiokawa, and it's the one that we've been working with, and they've been working with at Haystack as well. So you see, minute to minute, this is about 3 minutes per frame, you see large variability in the turbulence here. This is a log scale plot. In linear scale, it looks more like this. So you see that it doesn't look that bad, because you can still basically see the shadow. You expect to probably be able to resolve it, but there's still a rich ability to look at the turbulence there. So I just thought I'd make a little movie showing what this is doing to the visibility amplitudes over time. So this is the EHD baseline track through one Earth rotation, and as the source rises and set, we add or tracks go away. And on the left-hand side, you see the visibility amplitudes jumping around from minute to minute on all of these different baselines that are observing the source at any given time. You see, it's quite drastic how much these are jumping up and down. And one thing that's important to note is that there actually are error bars in this plot, which are from expected EHT thermal noise. In reality, we'll have gain errors and calibration problems that will make the error bars much bigger. But in theory, at least, if we could get to the thermal noise limit, the EHT should really be able to see these fluctuations happening from minute to minute. 10-second integration times like we have here. This is the effect on the phases over time, the same movie. You can see that on the short baselines, the phase isn't changing that much. This is just because the large quiescent structure is not changing very much from minute to minute. But on large baselines, you see really drastic fluctuations in phase from up to like 100 degrees per 3 minute frame. Then we also have effects on imaging. If you take an average model, we can image it. This is the average of one of those movies. We can just image it with BSMEM, for instance, and get a pretty good reconstruction of the shadow. But if we just naively take a movie observation and try to image it, we're going to get complete nonsense, because BSMEM is trying to image, especially using those long baseline data, things that don't come from a consistent frame. So we need to think carefully about how we would approach this problem. And just briefly, this is so a function of sort of a correlation timescale in the UV plane of the visibilities of one of these movies. So you see it has all this very interesting structure. And what's especially apparent is that the EHT will be able to see a lot of these changes in structure. So in the middle, we have very long timescales of correlation because again, the quiescent structure isn't changing that much. But we drop off pretty rapidly to much lower timescales. And we should be able to see over the course of observations on different baselines this sort of structure. And so the EHT is really in a great position to look at time variability on spatially resolved scales in the near future. And this pattern, this is very preliminary, but this pattern changes pretty drastically of slight switches in the changes in the model. So this is just the same model due to two different inclinations, for instance. At 85 degrees, you can see it's more extended. The correlation is more extended on the east-west direction because that's sort of the preferred axis. So then when you're looking at more top-down, you see more circular shape. And then if you increase the accretion rate, you see that as you expect, the correlation time scale drops pretty rapidly. So there's a lot of potential to tease out physics here, even though it may not be clear at the moment. So one thing that, talking about looking at time averaging of the images and being able to extract the quiescent image from the variable structure, this is work that Frank Roloff did at Haystack this last summer. So the red line here is the visibility amplitudes from the average image, and the blue line is just the average of movie observations over 8 days of observing. And you can see, even though we're averaging over 8 different days, there's still a huge amount of scatter about the average image visibilities. And if we try to image this, we might see a shadow, but it'd probably be very unclear. So what Frake did was he first averaged it, but then he normalized it by total flux to account for variabilities just from the entire image brightening and dimming, and then took a moving average of these visibilities over each baseline track. And you can see that really brings the movie reconstruction in line with the average image data. And then re-imaging with PSMEM was able to reconstruct the shadow pretty well. So while we might think that this variable structure should cause problems for making movies, I think this is just one technique, one recipe, but we've already come up with recipes that seem to do a good job, and we'll probably continue to do that. The much harder question is looking at the variability itself and trying to extract physics there. And this is really hard because we can't, of course, image it on short timescales. We need a full Earth rotation to be able to produce an image. So we need to rely on closure phases and amplitudes, as we've been talking about all week, which are immune to effects of phase variability and gain errors, and which are only limited by thermal noise, and which we can therefore drive down even on short integration times by increasing our bandwidth. So work that was done a while ago by Shep et al. Was looking at the effects on closure phases and amplitudes of hotspot orbits. So this is a simple but a good initial model of what we might expect to see with the EHT. And so what we see is this, from these orbits, you can see immediately a variability in the closure phases and amplitudes on EHT baseline. And this scatter, this periodicity is apparent even at the lower bandwidth, and when you increase the bandwidth, you drive down the errors substantially. And critically, these line up, the periodicities line up. And so with many different triangles or quadrangles in closure amplitude, you could see the same periodicity repeat and be able to measure pretty accurately the periodicity of the orbit of the hotspot. This is the correlation function of those closure phases, and what you expect to get a periodicity out of it is that all the peaks, this is one frame, but if you were to look at all of the different tracks, all the peaks would line up. And they did in the simple model. Of course, if we're looking at a more complicated thing, we don't expect to see those simple peaks as neatly. But I think one thing that is worth emphasizing is that these closure phases and amplitudes can still be very important observables, and we can choose our triangles and quadrangles intelligently to extract some information out of them. I think there's a refutation that closure phases and amplitudes are very confusing and like they don't really relate to physics, but or they don't like relate in a transparent way. But if we can choose what we're looking at intelligently, we might be able to really get information out of them. So one thing that's already been done is looking at the closure phase on this triangle. And as we mentioned before, we expect this to be zero in basically any model, because the closure phase on the SMT Karma baseline is going to be close to zero, and on the two Hawaii baselines will cancel out. So I mean, we see that in the GRMHB simulation. Any model will have close to zero closure phase on this triangle. But if we go to larger triangles, we expect the closure phase to show more variability, and indeed it does, including this large jump feature on the SMA Karma Alma baseline. And as you can see, it's much deviating much more from around zero on the larger triangle. And this is a very different characteristic pattern than what we saw in the hotspot model. So even without any sort of sophisticated analysis on these closure phases, we should be able to hopefully distinguish between different broad classes of models just from looking at the chaotic pattern here. And the upside down map here is not only a subtle way of deconstructing Western imperialism, but also, I think, a valid way of looking at the Earth from Sagittarius Star, since this is the South Pole is what's always visible. And CJ Craig does not understand. So closure amplitudes, we actually already have closure amplitudes, even though we might think we only have three stations. Closure amplitudes we have contain the baseline between karma and reference karma. This is actually a really, it might seem trivial, but it's really a good test, because basically, since you're taking the baseline from karma to reference karma, and then from reference karma to SMT, those are should be about the same around the total flux. And so really what you get in this this quantity that's immune to gain error is a ratio of two long baselines. And we can do this not only on what the baseline we currently have, but also to ALMA or to the South Pole telescope. And we see that in the baselines we currently have to Hawaii, the closure amplitudes are all very close to one, which we would expect because this is it's a long baseline, but it's still not as long as the other two, and it's not resolving the source as much. So we expect these baselines are very similar in length, so they will be seeing about the same thing. But when we go to the more distant stations for our fourth station, the baselines are still very similar, but the variability on these UV distances is much larger. And so in between the two similar baselines, we expect to see much more variation. And indeed, we do. And this large scatter in the SPT one is due to when I made these plots, assuming that the SPT would have a very large SESD. I think yesterday we talked about how that might not be able to be the case, promising results in driving that down. So this SPT plot in reality might look more like the ALMA SMT. And something that's probably maybe obvious but is important to check is that is this variability that we see just from the rotation of the Earth looking at some complicated structure, or does it in fact come from something intrinsic to the source? And this is work that we've done with Nina Hooper, who is an undergrad at Harvard, and she's generated a lot of plots like this, which show that there is some variability from Earth rotation, but it's nothing compared to the variability from the intrinsic source variability, and it occurs over much longer time scales. So that's good to know. Okay, so we have all of these plots, and we have all of these quantities, and I think it's we can look for triangles and for quadrangles that are easily interpretable, but we still, and we can look for large qualitative differences between models, but we still really need to start getting into quantitative techniques to apply to these data and to extract some signatures and predictive things so we can distinguish between models. And that's work we're just starting, so we're thinking about applying some methods from, for instance, the study of quasar light curves, which use an autoregressive process to model the flux, and potentially using that on visibility amplitudes. A long-term goal might be to, in fact, try to do movie imaging using a quiescent image as a prior on each of the individual frames. And I think what's really clear in all of this is that we need to have a lot of collaboration because communicating between these different models and observables is going to require that we test a lot of models, that we have a lot of access to them, and also that we understand what is going on between them. And I think it's also really an opportunity for people who, the collaboration between people in theory and modeling and observation. Also, I think a lot of techniques that people who are more familiar with instrumentation know about time series analysis would be really helpful here. So I don't think I have time to talk about polarization, but just to advertise, and this is mostly from Michael Johnson's paper on polarimetric astrometry, which is very good, and I recommend it. The polarization adds, of course, two quantities to this picture. And so it's automatically interesting because of that, and also because flares in Sagittarius Star are highly polarized. So we expect the polarization to be a real signature of physics. And what Michael showed was that polarization offsets are really sensitive. Our position offsets are cause drastic gradients in polarization. So you can have a small 1 microsecond offset between a small flaring source and between and a quiescent structure, and that would cause about a degree shift in position angle on a long baseline. So there's also longer time scale variability over the course of any observations that we can look at. So to summarize, VHTs already detected day-to-day changes in visibility amplitude on long and short baselines, essentially resolving spatially and temporally variability in Sag J star. This is going to be a critical thing for the EHT to do in the future. This offers a critical window on dynamics at the event horizon, and we really need to work on developing non-imaging techniques to interpret these variable data and work on establishing collaboration to bring together insights from modeling and also from observing. So, thanks.
Thank you, Andrew. So do we have any questions? We have 5 minutes. Okay.
So I had a quick question about a slight detail in one of your closure phase plots.
Yeah.
You showed that you would never expect large closure phases on a certain triangle, right? The Karma SMA SMTO baseline. I think we're getting close, but it was a different one where you showed multiple plots on the same slide. Yes, here. So basically, in this bottom plot, there are several instances in time where the error bars suddenly grow to quite large values. I was just wondering about that. Could you tell me what's going on there?
That's because the error in the phase is essentially the error in the real or imaginary part over the visibility amplitude. And so when you have a low visibility amplitude on one of these long baselines, I can drive up the error in the phase by a lot.
Robert?
Switch on it. Your idea of using the quiescent image as a prior. Another field where this is a very lively topic at the moment is synthesis imaging of the sun, which has very many of the same problems because you have, you know, particularly if you're trying to image the quiet sun, you have this network of, you know, continually changing stuff across the field. And it's a very difficult problem, which we've been thinking about a bit in the context of ALMA solar imaging. And the techniques, I think, are very close. So it might be interesting to explore collaborations in that area.
Yeah, I think that'd be really interesting. Yeah, we're always looking for people to collaborate on imaging things. We're working with people in the MIT GRIT team right now. I think also extending it to techniques for solar imaging would be really valuable.
Dimitrios.
This is a more general question about the AHT and variability. Something that we learned in the X-rays for doing accretion, you know, normal X-ray binaries and AGN was that how well you measure variability depends extremely sensitively on mundane things like, you know, time binning and integration and gaps, because windowing kills you very, and aliasing in the Fourier transforms kills you very easily. That's why there was a lot of, you know, progress in X-ray binaries and no progress in AGN because of the characteristic time scales being long. Is that an issue with the HT? Will we be able to control the rate at which things are being recorded and no gaps for, you know, hours long time series?
Don't quite know the details about.
I think what you're asking is, if you want to binning the data or how you handle the data, I think those are really good questions. So I would add that noise on the closure phases is still a little bit of a mystery because no one's actually gone through and done the analytical probability density function for noise on a closure phase for all the different signal noise ratios one would expect on a triangle. So even at that level, there are some unknowns. But I think one could, on a pipeline basis, one could Monte Carlo a bunch of stuff to figure out what the data, the error propagation through the whole pipeline, things like that, and try to find out what the optimal.
Yeah, I was not concerned about error propagation. I was concerned about windowing that takes sharp features and turns them into ups and downs and bobs and edges and things that you can never model, like time windowing and time binning.
I'm just saying, I think we should simulate it and find out what the effects are.
Okay, thanks. So Marecki, do you want to get set up? I'm actually going to just make a follow-on comment to Andrew. I think your maps were the best of any I've seen, quite original deconstruction or not. And I was quite struck, actually, by the difference, as a non-theorist, by the difference in the presentation of one of the models on a logarithmic amplitude scale versus a linear amplitude scale. And I guess noise isn't modeled in that either, because I think the, I don't know if you have any comment on that, but if it was a noisy model, I think the benefit of the logarithmic amplitude revealing all that detail might have been washed out.